This is the Blacklist Podcast. I'm your host, as always, founder and CEO of the Blacklist, Franklin Leonard, joined by
Kate Hagan, Director of Community at the Blacklist.
We have a legend in the building today, Academy Award winner, Akiva Goldsman. Pretty much put on a masterclass, Kate, right?
Yeah, screenwriters, this is the episode for you. We have many conversations about writing, but Akiva gets to a depth about his own work and how he thinks about writing that I think is really rare and spectacular. We're going to talk to Akiva about his writerly beginnings, including the funniest Gordon Lish story I think you've ever heard. We're going to talk about his beginnings in Brooklyn and how his early family life influenced him as a writer. We're going to talk a bit about his memories of Joel Schumacher on the late 90s Batman films. And finally, we're going to bring it up to the present by talking a bit about what Akiva has been watching lately and what movie he thinks everybody on planet Earth should watch. It's a really good answer for that one.
A truly lovely conversation with a truly lovely man. So yeah, without further ado, here's me and Kate with Akiva Goldsman.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, Akiva, we love to begin every conversation the same way, and that is by asking if you can remember the very first movie that you saw in a movie theater, and please set the scene for us.
I've got two options. One is Bambi in a drive-in, and the other is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes at the Duffield Theater in Brooklyn. I remember very little about the drive-in except trauma. The fire scene fucked me up. I was really scared and I cried a lot and my father yelled at me. So that's probably more than you needed to know, but that was the first actual cinematic experience other than the television set. But my first movie was Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. It was the Duffield Theater on Fulton Street. I grew up in downtown Brooklyn and Brooklyn was not then as it is now. It was rated M. Movies were rated M. And I was so obsessed with the idea of seeing it. And I still kind of remember some version of the closing speech. Like it literally imprinted in my brain. In retrospect, I'm sure it was like Vancouver, but it seemed like the future, whatever the location of the shot was. You know, and it was just amazing, extraordinary, especially in New York, in the world where entertainment was not available in the way it is now, right? For people who are really old like me, it was being transported. Like you would go, really would go into a dark place and it would be, you know, I think it was summer and air conditioning would be on and the sound would be extraordinary. I mean, remember, we didn't even have stereos at that point. You know, right. So it was a different world. And, you know, we talk now about the movie going experience, the cinema experience. In those days, a normal movie was to us as IMAX is to folks today. Like it was so immersive and that was it. And Roddy McDowall had a mask.
And the Duffield, I imagine, was like so many of those like old movie houses, you know, like 1,000 seats, right? Like, so I'm just curious. And look, I think both Kate and I and probably everyone are feeling a little bit nostalgic for the movie-going experience, period. But the experiences that we all have right now, I think, is even very different from back when there were movie palaces.
Yeah.
I'm just curious how you think about that experience, both as a filmmaker now, but also as somebody who, like, sort of was introduced to movies in that way, to even the cinematic experience now and sort of what you think we've lost or maybe even gained, I don't know.
I think in terms of sort of the physical plant, right, in terms of the actual brick-and-mortar component, even though it was far more primitive then, it was more exotic. Their seats were red velvet. There were ushers. There were sections. You know, they were leftovers from vaudeville or from theater or from burlesque. And so there was this feeling of going into another world. And I think that that abides to some extent today. I mean, certainly I think what we do is we chase that with technology. But I also think something happened, at least over the course of my lifetime, which is movies and television inverted. You know, when I was a kid, there were four stations. Well, there were three stations. There was CBS, NBC, and ABC. And then we had a New York Channel 11 and Channel 5, and then Channel 9. And television was for everybody, right? But I remember seeing 2001 with my friend. God, I wonder if that was before Conquest. I remember seeing 2001 in 1969, probably was, with my friend Jonathan Leeds' father, Robert. And there were three of us in the movie theater. Movies were for the few people who found them. And that's switched now. Now movies, in order to support the economics of the creation of an object of that scope and size, have to be ubiquitous. They have to be for Quadrant. They have to be for anybody. And basically Netflix seems to have an algorithm where if you and me and you and you and you and six of our friends will agree to watch it, they'll make a show. Because yeah, they figure out how to target the audience and the advertising in their advertising in terms of getting more subscriptions, yeah, in a way that sort of creates niche objects. So movies were the place where you went for that which was rare, and television was the place where you went to that which was common. And that is inverted now. Now movies are the place you go to for that which is common. And I mean common in the best sense. We share it. It is not an active community, a Marvel movie. But something that is niche can exist now on streaming in ways that your favorite show and my favorite show might both be quite expensive and we may never have seen each other because, in fact, they're targeted for smaller groups of folks. So I think that weirdly, the experience that we used to get from going to movies, one now gets, at least in terms of content seeking, we get out of streaming.
I'm curious where you'd throw fiction into that mix. And I ask that in anticipation of Kate's next question, knowing that you have an MFA in fiction writing.
Yeah.
There's a notion of making something that is sort of universal, right? Like this claim thing that we talk about in the four quadrant film versus making something sort of niche and artful that I don't disagree with you, by the way, about that economic shift, but I'm curious, let's throw in books and theater on top of it. Like, how do you think about those audiences? And I suspect you do think about it a fair amount and how those interact with film and television as well.
Well, I think that, again, the proliferation of material because of the accessibility and proliferation of platforms has made that which is small and unique available, right? That's the really interesting thing about the internet. The good and the bad thing about the internet is you can find your cohort, which is really great if you are marginalized in the middle of the country or surrounded by people who feel a lack of empathy and are ignorant enough not to understand that human is human, and really terrible if you're a Nazi, right? Like, you know, because in the old days, you wouldn't meet another Nazi probably on your block, but now you can find the other Nazi no matter where they are. And so the internet, right, becomes the opportunity to bring everything home. And so I think for fiction, you know, when you combine that with this sort of the absence now of the brick and mortar bookstore or the almost total absence of the brick and mortar bookstore, the fading of the brick and mortar book so that, you know, you can actually write and publish on the internet without ever having paid actual physical pages, I think it does allow folks to find exactly what they want and share in a community that wants it exactly. And then I still do think there are those things that are used, I mean, for more popular entertainment. They're targeted to be larger. I think Broadway has very much moved in that direction. I mean, you know, I'm really now off-Broadway and Broadway are different places.
Yeah. One is Marvel musicals, with the exception of like Jeremy O'Harris and Terrell McCraney, and then off-Broadway is like doing incredibly avant-garde stuff that, you know, most audience members are, I mean, even me on occasion, if I'm being honest, are like, I don't know what's happening here.
Right. And when I was a kid, that was not the case at all. That Off-Broadway was literally the step to Broadway.
Right. Right.
So in the same way that Hamilton sort of started at BAM and moved, like, that's how plays got to Broadway. And they all moved through Off-Broadway, not all, but many did. And, you know, and no more.
While we're on the subject of cinematic and writerly beginnings, I do want to take us back. As Franklin mentioned, you have an MFA from NYU's fiction writing program. And throughout your career, you found this great balance of these really fascinating portraits of real life figures with more sort of cosmic explorations in the world of sci-fi. So I'm wondering, were you always interested in science fiction? And how did that decision then sort of help you make the transition from fiction writing into screenwriting?
So I have always been interested in science fiction from the time I was very, very small. It was the thing that worked for me in terms of escape. Yes, so I needed, like many of us, I had a pretty aversive home circumstance. Writing and reading became, in large part, the way to escape conflict. Also, I'm not very good, certainly wasn't as a child or a young man or a middle-aged man, at self-soothing. So these became ways to disconnect from the anxiety. I like it. The first things I wrote were science fiction when I was really very young. For me, it just is congenial to my imagination. And the reason that I went from fiction writing to screenwriting is I was a shit fiction writer. And it was disappointing to such an extreme degree that it's so delightful that it's now a comedy. I really wanted to write. That was what I wanted to do. And for some of the right reasons, just to fantasize about having a book on a shelf with my name on it. I mean, it was just all this, like, I could see myself, I could find a way to recognize myself as a writer if I could just do it, I thought. So I tried really hard. And, you know, I'm a lover of short story. Like, for me, that's the, just such the art form. Like, and a perfect short story, a Flannery O'Connor short story, a Raymond Carver short story. I'm just, you know, they're like magic to me. And I went to NYU and I had the best fiction writing teachers. I had Russell Banks and E.L. Doctorow and Margaret Atwood. I mean, just sort of crazy.
Yeah, it's a strong list. That's a strong list.
Yeah. And then, you know, and I just couldn't sell a thing. Yeah. I mean, I have 10 years of rejection. That's literally 10 years of writes. I mean, Roger Angel in The New Yorker hand-typed, no, you're never going to make. I mean, there were a lot of them. I mean, he was kinder than that in telling me I wasn't going to make it. But, and then I two things happened. One was a guy named Gordon Lish, who was sort of this famous editor for Knopf and was called Captain Fiction. And he used to teach writers, and he would invite you, if you were worthy, to pay a ton of money to take this private seminar, which would meet once a week for 6 hours, no pee breaks, because he believed that if you did not have the strength to control your bladder, you did not have the strength to write fiction.
Wait, seriously?
Dead serious. So, but what he did is, it was kind of in a funny way, I mean, weirdly, and I say this hyperbolically, but it was a little bit asked for fiction. Like, you would write a short story every week and you would start to read, and then you'd get in one sentence and he'd go, that's shit. I'll tell you why that's shit. Goldsman, everybody was laughing at that shit. But I remember Amy Hempel and Mark Richard were my guys going, now Hempel sentence was good. And, you know, and he would just like, and you were, and by the way, it's not like you got to read it again next week. You had to write a whole new one. But it stripped you of pretense, right? It forced you to find a voice. His theory was, in the din of voices, authenticity is the only thing that's going to stick to that. And then I went and I took a Robert McKee course. And I went, oh, fuck, there's structure here. So if I can't figure out how to get out of the short story, because I understand that there's some relationship between how I started and how I ended, but it's unpredictable. I understand the relationship of three-act structure to an audience. I understand the relationship of the acts to themselves, because he's teaching me it. And by now, my ear wasn't bad. And so I figured, maybe a strictly mediocre fiction writer could be a good enough screenwriter. And that's exactly what happened.
I am curious, we're going to talk about some of your earlier work in just a minute, but I'm curious, you know, so much of your screenplays have been in the world of adaptation, including your best adapted screenplay, Oscar for A Beautiful Mind. And I feel like to people outside of the business, the whole process of adaptation is really opaque. It's just very, you know, how does anyone do this? I'm wondering at what point in your screenwriting career did you realize that you had a particular knack for adaptation? And does that writing process differ at all versus when you're working on ideas that you've generated?
I love adaptation. I sort of turn out to be somebody who loves coloring inside the lines. I think in part because when I was a kid, like I can't write by hand. My whole eye-hand coordination is not good.
Same.
So when I color, like when it was all over, I was like, brr. So for me, I love the idea of that which you can interact with or contaminate, honestly. Like, so, you know, Beautiful Mind is a great example of this because, and this is really true for almost all my adaptations, which is the more I have a collision with the source material in a way that is full of conflict, the better for me the result. So in the sense, Beautiful Mind was a benign version of that because the biography, which was brilliant, was reportage. John Nash did not engage with Sylvia Nasser. They didn't really talk about his insides, right? And as one of the very early group homes for emotionally disturbed children was in my house. My parents founded it. So I grew up, you know, with people like hanging the baby out the window or banging the baby against the wall, and I was the baby. So as I got older, I too had trouble distinguishing real from not real. And I was really messed up, and you know, and by the way, when the other kids in the house get attention by banging their heads against the wall, you start banging your head against the wall. And so as I got older, I always held with me a labile distinction between sane and insane. It was always a little fuzzy for me. So here we have this man who suffers from this illness that I understand personally from proximity, and I can imagine a version of his insides that are not his. You know, there are no invisible people in the biography. Those are all amalgams of feelings that I made up. So I had my view of, I would like to show people the experience of being schizophrenic, right? I'd like to at least approximate that. And in order to do that, I have this amazing opportunity because I have a man who suffered and who had an incredible life. And then I have this palette of grammar that I believe is about how suffering schizophrenia feels to somebody who suffers it. And I smashed them together, right? I mean, Time to Kill, in the book, Jake Briggins is racist. He just doesn't know it. So I changed it. I made the crescendo of the book him discovering his own racism. Because for me, that was a collision with the source material that allowed me, I was not raised entirely by people who have the same color skin as me. So for me, that was really important. So we have these opportunities to take our own lives and then that which exists outside as an object and try to marry them or merge them or have them coexist in a way that's synthetic and harmonic. I love doing it. I just think it's fun and surprising. And so my version of adaptation is that which may be very different from somebody else's. I can tell you that the most literal adaptation that I've ever done is The Da Vinci Code. And even though it is that which has made the most money probably of any movie, I'm with love the least interested in the screenplay because it adheres too closely.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm really interested. It's funny because when people talk about the screenplay form and the novel form, one of the primary distinctions they make is that a screenplay is ultimately the things you can see, and therefore it's like these things happen, these things happen, these things happen, whereas fiction is traditionally thought of as a place where you can actually investigate the inner lives of the characters. And yet what you're describing in both Time to Kill and A Beautiful Mind is the injection of the emotional interior life of the principal characters into the fiction so that it can be carried off as an effective movie. And I'm just curious, that feels unusual given the way people generally frame fiction and the screenplay form, but it's ultimately that emotional interior life that makes a successful movie in my experience. So I'm just curious how you think about that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting point. And I think to some degree, that generalization, which is very, very popular, right?
Yeah.
There's sort of a little fallacy that happens, especially outside the industry, which is the screenplays that we publish, or that somebody publishes, we don't publish, somebody goes, hey, we're going to publish your screenplay. And you're like, yay, look, I have a cover. But those are the shooting scripts.
Right.
And it says shooting script. And the shooting script has nothing to do with the script you saw. So the script you write, Shane Black had described a room once. I don't even know what script it was. He was describing, it was about clearly Bruce Willis's room, but I don't know what he said. Throw everything you own from a plane. It will land like this. And I just thought, oh, it's so good. Right now,
really good.
Right? And what it's doing is the job of the first draft, which is to evoke the emotional life of the reader. Right? That's your job. Your job is to get them feeling and ultimately the director feeling so that right from the beginning, you're like, I'm in your kishkas, as my late mother would have said, which is some combination of balls and heart, if there was one in Yiddish. And so it's, how do I speak to your emotions with my words? And so in that draft, when you start, I think it's full of things that are not technically that which can survive. Now, you don't want to go too far because then people are like, what? He doesn't know how to write a screenplay. But if you pepper it in enough, if you create enough understanding of emotion over the course of the object, as it transitions from screenplay to movie, objective correlatives will occur. Those things will become things we can see and touch. But load it with feeling first.
I completely agree. It's just so good to hear somebody that's done as much as you have confirm that.
We love to see it. We truly do. I'm glad you mentioned A Time to Kill because I wanted to talk a bit about the late, great Joel Schumacher. I have to tell you, Akiva, 25 years ago was my first summer of going to the movies, and the centerpiece movie of that summer was Batman Forever, no question. That's one of four collaborations that you created with Joel Schumacher. So I'm curious what kind of sticks out most from your experience working with him, not only on those two, I think, great, aged beautifully 90s Batmans, as well as two excellent John Grisham adaptations with A Time to Kill and The Client.
Well, thank you. I'll say first something a little bit about collaboration, and then I'll talk about Joel, if that's okay, because I'm sort of a serial collaborator. You know, it's five movies with Ron Howard, four with Will Smith, three with Russell Crowe. You know, that's what I do. You know what I mean? Like for me, and I learned that from Joel. I learned a lot. I was going to say everything. It's not true, but I learned a lot from Joel. And Joel was also the person who welcomed. I wrote a script that people really liked, but didn't sell at first. It floated around. It was a script called Indian Summer that became a movie called Silent Fall, which at like 4 a.m. on HBO you can see sometimes. And it was very kind of like, it was the days of the spec script. And I followed it out here and it didn't sell, and it did ultimately, but people were reading it, and somebody, Lorenzo de Bonaventura, who is a CE at Warner Brothers, sent it to Joel Schumacher, and he invited me over to his house at Stone Canyon Road. Like, you know, I mean, and Joel was, unlike anyone else I've ever known. And he was tall and broken and beautiful and brilliant and terrified and brave. It was this extraordinary combination of a man who was as successful as anybody could ever be in the movie business and was still in his heart the most beautiful boy on Fire Island in the summer in the 60s. And it was, and I loved him. And I made him into my father, which is what I tended to do. And he had no desire to be my father, but I did it anyway. And he was crazy and he was just getting sober. And we had this intensely cathected relationship where we just went, like, we just kind of, I honestly, even though he took me from that meeting and said, by the time I got home, there were messages on my answering machine. We didn't have car phones then. And it was Lorenzo. He said, you got the job. I was like, I got what job? He said, well, he wants you to go. He has to go to Cannes with Falling Down. So he wants you to go tomorrow, meet him at the airport, and then take the book of the client. They don't like the screenplay. Fly to New York, meet with Susan Sarandon, and start. And I was like, you know, and I, of course, have seen the Rocky Horror Show 26 times. So the idea that I was going to meet with Susan Sarandon was more than could possibly be managed. And I did. And I never left. He took me on set. I was on set every day of every one of those movies. He taught me how to be not just a film writer for real, but that's how I learned to be a producer. He loved actors, but sometimes he'd get frustrated with them. So he'd say, "Hun, take the script, go work it out with Tommy Lee. Go work it out with Susan. Go work it out." That's how I learned that I liked actors and that I enjoyed writing with them and for them. And he was an extraordinary force. And I'm going to miss him.
It's one of those things that I feel like only in his passing that a lot of people realize that he was the architect of so many movies that kind of defined our childhoods, our teenagerhoods, and, you know, coming from that world that he came from of production design and set design. I mean, I rewatched Batman Forever and Batman and Robin a couple of weeks ago. Just in awe of these sets and these beautiful, huge cinematic moments. And I still don't think Joel Schumacher gets enough credit as one of those sort of architects of the modern blockbuster and the modern summer movie. But if there is one silver lining to his passing, I think that a lot of people have realized how much his films have meant to them over the years. And that's a great way of talking about your producing career as well, which is something I was curious about. You've been a producer on a lot of really fascinating projects beyond your work as a screenwriter, everything from Constantine to the Paranormal Activity films to most recently Dr. Sleep. I'm curious what being a producer has taught you about screenwriting and what being a screenwriter has taught you about producing?
Well, I think that today writer-producers are not simply the domain of television, but they kind of were in my day. There was Walter Parks who had done it, and then there was nobody. And I lived, like all screenwriters of that era, in terror of being fired. You know, and part of it is because I just was a scared person to some extent when I was younger. And so I was always waiting for the other shoe to fall. But also screenwriters are getting fired right and left. That's how it happened. I mean, Joel happened to never fire me, but boy, I thought he was going to a bunch of times. And so I sort of thought at a certain point, well, what if I was the one to fire me? And this Ron Howard will laugh. He said to me, I've seen you do it. I've seen you fire you. And it's true. I thought, well, I would like to be able to guide this process in a way that doesn't marginalize the screenwriter, because screenwriters were so terribly marginalized in those days. It's less so now. Not ideal, but it's less.
I was going to say, it's still true, though, and it's bad for business, which is the wildest part.
It's bad for business. It's bad for your soul. It's bad for creativity. It's bad for the object. Like, yep. You know, the problem with movies is they become these sort of reverse Rorschachs. You know, there's this opportunity for people to like spray their psychology out on everybody, and which is okay if you're loving and want everybody to do well. But otherwise, it can be really awful, and people do things in the name of creativity that are uncivil. And so I do not advocate that in any way. I believe that what we do is a joy and should be a joy. I believe in collaborative art, even though that's oxymoronic. So it felt like as a producer, I would have a better chance of doing that. And I really what it was school. We made the first movie I produced, I guess, was Lost in Space. had no idea what we were doing. Fired the line producer after 3 days. I think that we shot like 170 days. It was just the worst thing ever. It was such school. We were in London. It was unbelievable. And I learned a lot about what not to do. I had to make some friends and blow up a marriage and all the things that you do when you're suddenly young and can produce a movie. But the one that really taught me was Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which was just like no other movie that I've ever made before or since. And I really realized that all the things we imagine as kids about the way structures work are nonsense, that everybody is just 11 years old pretending to be a grown-up and just let's all get together. As Will Smith often says, my dad's got a barn, let's put on a show. Like, that's what we're doing. And if you're pretending you know more, you're lying. And if you think you have all the answers, you're that one guy who has all the answers, because none of the rest of us do. And it's a great way to get smarter and do better work and have fun, because it's play. So that's producing let me be not scared, I guess. It let me say to a group of people in thought and action, my dad's got a barn, let's put on a show.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I want to ask you a little bit more about collaboration, and it's weird that you sort of dipped into that and anticipated the question. But like you said, you are sort of a bit of a serial monogamist when it comes to creative partnerships. How do you manage it when there are, like, it is inevitable that even when people are being mature adults, that they're going to be creative, good faith disagreements about what should happen next? And you've been at various stages of the business with this sort of approach of collaborative joy, but like, how do you resolve those potentially real conflicts when they're coming from good faith sort of argumentation?
Well, I feel like conflict is less problematic when it comes from good faith. I feel like it's less tricky to actually unwind, which doesn't mean it isn't actually ever tricky. I mean, sometimes it is for sure. I think it has a lot to do with your partners. You know, I mean, Will Smith, you know, his version is kind of like, you just don't say no. You just, like, you'll just talk till somebody says yes, right? Which is sort of neat. You know, Ron just listens, you know, he just takes it all in. It's a lot of it is, I think, being lucky enough to find the right folks to play with and then getting to the point where you can kind of seek them out. But I also think that the training from being a screenwriter was, I had zero power, right? As we discussed earlier, it's really low on the totem pole. And yet I wanted to inform what we were doing. Felt like I had a right to inform what we were doing because I had written it.
I mean, you would think the writer would have some input.
But as you know, not necessarily, right, once you're on set. And so I had to be convincing. I had to be good at convincing people to do a thing, not bossing them, because I couldn't boss. And that turns out not to be so terrible.
I want to go back to a second to the adaptation thing, and I'm specifically interested in when you're telling the story of true life figures. Like, it's one thing to adapt Da Vinci Code, right? And you have some obligation to the text and the writer of the novel, but that's a very different thing than, like, telling the story of a person who's no longer here. I'm fascinated by this notion of colliding the emotional, like, your interior life, essentially, that overlaps with the character. But how do you manage the, like, what are the guardrails as you tell a true life story emotionally and cinematically, if that makes any sense?
It makes total sense. I think the problem is the guardrails are subjective, you know? And so for me, I always used to say, I want to get the truth, not the facts, right? But truth is subjective, right? So I believed and continue to believe in a story, a tale that can be told with a life, if I can find it in that life. And I want to make sure, as well as I can, that that is a tale that to be told that the person whose life it was would advocate. And then I create, because the idea of adaptation, cinematic adaptation of biography is, it's just a sheer absurdity. I mean, you're going to take 70 years and you're going to crush it into 2 hours. I mean, the very act of omission is creation, right? I mean, so you kind of have to figure, or at least that's true. I typically sort of go, well, I'm telling the story of a life because we like to learn from lives. So it's a little bit of a bedtime story. It's a fairy tale. It's a promise. It's a cautionary tale. John Nash really did have schizophrenia. John Nash really did find himself in a relationship where he was loved for many, many years. John Nash really did heal from schizophrenia. Okay. Now, that's the story I told. There are pieces I didn't tell. John Nash and Alicia divorced, then got back together. Do you know what I mean? So, right? And, you know, John's son had schizophrenia. So that is the Jim Braddock story became an inspirational story of fighting for survival. You know, Jim Braddock was more complex than that.
But so do you just sort of commit to, like, this is the emotional story that I'm telling, and I just have to make peace with the reality of these omissions? Or do you find yourself trying to fit some of the stuff in because you feel like you have to add it just to, like, sort of be honest about their lives? Or, like, is there a process in managing that, or you just set it aside?
No. It's a constant process. And I think that you actually can't commit to doing it until you are sure that that which you believe is necessary for the story is not that which will require too much omission or a violation of guardrails in the wrong way. Like, I think that you actually have, I don't think you can do it. Well, it was interesting. I mean, this is not the same, but in Time to Kill, I actually didn't know. I was going to tell Joel no, because he sent it to me and I read it and I couldn't get there. I didn't know what to do. And then at the end, there's this one little thing that happens in the jury box that I turned into a very long speech of Matthew McConaughey. It's not that is in the book, because I saw my way through and I understood that there was a truth in this that was in the book, in my opinion. It just needed to be seen from a different point of view. So it was a truth in the book, just like there is a truth in a life. And if I feel like I'm getting to a truth that exists there, great. If I'm just making it up, or if I'm letting go of too many things that I feel are, and again, subjectively pivotal to understanding the truth of that person, then I won't do it.
Got it. So we are beginning to run out of time. We have a series of questions that we ask sort of as a speed round that we're going to go back and forth on. I'll kick it off. In the entire history of cinema, who is the movie character who you most identify with? And I'm going to add additionally who you didn't write.
Probably Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life.
Note to viewers, behind Akiva during this conversation, there is in fact a poster for It's a Wonderful Life, so the proof is in the pudding. Here's a fun one. What is a movie that everyone generally agrees upon to be terrible, but you will defend with your life?
That should be, you mean that everyone thinks is terrible?
Yeah, but you're like, I am the contrarian. I think this is a great piece of cinema.
Or even if you don't think it's a great piece of cinema, you love it, and so you don't care that it's not a great piece of cinema.
Do you know a movie called Legacy with Eric Stoltz and Chris Walken about fallen angels and what it's like to be a soldier for God, some of which I stole for Tilda Swinton's speech in Constantine. That.
It's a great movie. There's a great monologue by Viggo Mortensen as the devil. He eats a heart. It's, yeah, what's not to like?
It's everything you want.
What is the movie you find yourself recommending to friends most often?
I mean, it's probably It's a Wonderful Life.
Fair.
I mean, it's Philadelphia Story's right up there. Blade Runner's right up there.
I'm going to ask the next one, and then I'm going to let Kate ask the final two. So I had the good fortune of working for Sidney Pollack in the final year of his life with Anthony. And one of the things that stuck with me about the many conversations we had about sort of storytelling generally was that he was only interested in telling stories about two subjects, and that was love and war, because they were the only two things that as humankind we have no greater understanding of now than we did thousands of years ago, which has rung in my head since that conversation. And it begets what we call the Sidney Pollack question, which is, what is your favorite movie about love and what is your favorite movie about war?
My favorite movie about love might be The English Patient.
I mean, by the way, that's in part how they ended up working together, is that Sidney saw Truly Madly Deeply and said, this is a person who thinks about love in the same way that I do. And literally, that's how they ended up partnering. It's really funny that you mentioned that.
I think my favorite movie about war, even though it's not technically about war, is Schindler's List.
I think there are lots of opportunities for war stories beyond combat, and that's a great example of that. I'll take us into our final two questions, the first of which is, what single movie moment, this can be a cut, a shot, a scene, an ending beat, has stayed with you the longest?
Like, what's the indelible one that rings in your head forever?
I mean, I feel like I'm 9 years old by saying this. Punch it, Chewie.
That's a great answer. There is no shame in that answer, sir.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's one of those that takes you back immediately. I will take us home with the final question, and that is, if you could hold a worldwide screening of one movie simultaneously for every person on planet Earth, what movie would you choose?
I think today it would be Black Panther. I believe that our whole job as makers of movies we're empathy generators. I think that's what we're supposed to do. I think that's what we were put here to do. And, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, I would have said, guess who's coming to dinner? But, I think that like many white men my age, we're realizing our own failures, even thinking we weren't failing. So I think that guess who's coming to dinner has too much of that in it, despite its elegance for its time. So I think Black Panther, because I think the messaging I want to be, if I'm showing it to the whole world, available for children and adults. So I'm going to go with Black Panther.
I mean, look, the upside of that is it seems like most people have seen it. So we may just be like sort of a second viewing for most of literally every person on Earth. But I frankly love that answer. And thank you for the conversation, Akiva. It's always good when all the good things that you've heard about people get confirmed over the course of one conversation. So thank you.
This is a great chat. Thanks for going so deep on craft. I don't know that we've had a guest who has been able to dig in that much in terms of the nitty gritty of writing. So that's going to be really exciting for our listeners.
There may have been an IM to Kate during this conversation that was just, OMG, this is amazing. So thank you, sincerely. We remain fans, and I look forward to running into you in person when we are allowed to leave our houses.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you both.
From Luminary, the Blacklist podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are me, Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Sani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Patel composed our theme music, and this episode was edited and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter at Franklin Leonard, at Franklin J. Leonard on Instagram. Kate is That Hagen Girl, girl, G-R-R-L, on both, and we, The Blacklist, are the, T-H-E-B-L-C-K-L-S-T.